Stuart Hoskins, December 8, 1981. This is Donald Kobler interviewing Stuart Hoskins, December 8, 1981. Tell us who you are.
This is Stuart Hoskins being interviewed by Donald Kobler. I don't know why, but...
All right. Tell us how you and Ann happened to acquire the Lakeville Journal.
Is it on?
Right. Mm-hmm.
How do you do? This is Stuart Hoskins being interviewed. I am told that this is important for the history of the future of the world, but aside from that, the Lakeville Journal is a subject under a what? My wife and I came up to Lakeville in 1940 because we wanted to get away from New York City, because that was at the tail end of the Big Depression, and I was getting nowhere then. We wanted to move out of the city and get to the country. We also wanted a little business of our own. I wrote many letters, saw many people, and finally received a letter from Mrs. Dorothy Belcher, who then owned the Lakeville Journal, and said, come up and see us. So we did. After 6 months of talking about it and working on the problems, looking it over, talking to people in the town, we thought Lakeville and Salisbury was one of the loveliest places possible to live in. Being a country boy myself,
where did you grow
Sam
up?
Sam Irwin.
I
grew up in a very small village, even smaller than Lakeville, near Stamford, Connecticut, called Glenbrook. That is amusing because one of the first letters I ever received as a publisher of the journal was a critical letter saying, why don't you go back to where you came from, you city slicker? And my answer to that was, I came from a smaller place than Lakeville, so no more letters like that came in. But to follow the story, Mrs. Belcher had taken the journal over from the widow of Ben Jones, who had run the newspaper for 30-odd years. He had bought the paper from Carl, C-O-L, Card, C-A-R-D, who had started it in Millerton as a sort of adjunct to the Millerton Telegraph or some such name. And Ben Jones finally bought Mr. Card out, moved to Lakeville, and ran the paper for over 30 years, hiring Mrs. Belcher in an unusual circumstance, a woman operator of a mechanical linotype, which was rarely done in the 30s. And she worked hard and long for 20 or more years on that job, starting at, I think it was $5 a week, it may have been less. And she became quite good, very good. Well, when Mr. Jones died, they were talking about selling the paper, and Mrs. Belcher wanted to keep a job, and the widow of Mrs. Jones wanted to get rid of the paper. So the upshot was that they worked out a deal between themselves, which I don't know about, but at that time the paper was very small. It consisted of 4 pages of local news. It also consisted of filler news, which were received from outside in various ways, either in mat form. You want me to go into that?
Yes.
In mat form, like a cardboard impression of type, which had to be cast into a solid impression of type of metal right in the shop, or in plate form of a solid cast of the type done elsewhere and sent to the journal. And they were used as fillers. From that evolved a system by a big national organization whereby they sent to small weekly newspapers, filler pages completely printed with advertising and with national news and incidental news like how to grow a pig and how to cook a boiled egg.
Is this what was called boilerplate?
Boilerplate. And it was pre-printed. It made the local newspaper twice as big as it ordinarily would have been, which pleased everybody. The point was that in the early days, from 1890 up to 1940, very few newspapers had the small newspapers had the capacity to set enough type in a short length of time with the people available and print it, put it together, to turn out any size of size larger than four pages. In the early 1900s, much of the type, in the Lakeville Journal particularly, volume one, number one, much of that type was set by hand, one letter at a time. And then after that, Mr. Jones experimented with the forerunner of the linotype, which is a mechanical way of setting type. And from that, he finally got to the point where he could afford and could put in one linotype. And that was the one Mrs. Belcher ran, learned to run by herself there. Nobody knew anything about how to do it. And the paper was put together with the linotype. We also had facilities composed of a great big pot like the iron kettle up by the town hall, in which hot composite metal, mostly lead, was put in block form or miscellaneous form, and under which was a kerosene high pressure heater. You heated the metal up just the right temperature, which you guessed at, and then you poured that into a box-like affair, just the right thickness, as the same thickness as the type, and you poured that into a box against which the impressions, the cardboard impressions of type were put. Or you reused the slugs, which we call them, the linotype residue, which were saved once the paper was set in type and then was broken up, remelted, reused. So we reused that as a supplement to the linotype type and to make impressions from other sources. And
had you and Ann had any experience with this kind of thing before you came here?
We had no experience directly with the publication of a newspaper. I had had supplementary experience or in sources, in types of work, which I found very valuable to me up here. In New York City or in Jamaica, Long Island, I was in a big printing organization composed entirely of presses which printed national magazines. I had got an idea about what the back shop type of operation was in printing and in binding. I sold advertising of various sorts. I did miscellaneous work. I wrote a little odds and ends of things. I worked as a press agent for a real estate company and so forth. I had a certain amount of background, which all came in very handy, but I didn't know what was what when I came up here. We knew nobody in town, except later I found one person, who had walked into the shop one day and said, "By the way, you don't know it, but I was your mother's bridesmaid in New York City." And that was a relative of the Mitchell family. I forget her name now, but there were two sisters. The only person I knew in town. when we moved in. We moved into the building which is now the psychiatric center. What is it called?
Housatonic Mental Health Center.
Housatonic, yeah. We moved in there, rented it for a very low sum, and I came up a week ahead to get the house in order, and it was early spring, very cold, no heat in the house, and I had to figure out how to get the journal, take over the journal that week, and get ready for my wife and two children to come up. And it was a little bit hectic, but somehow or other we got the first issue out. Mrs. Belcher stayed on for 6 months or so as only linotype operator.
Where was the journal located then?
The journal is located in a small brown, now brown building between the hairdressers and the what used to be the old telephone building on Upper Main Street. It had a funny history itself. It's a tiny little building on a tiny little spot, plot of ground. And looking it over, it was two stories. It only looks like one story, but the back half was a second story underneath, opening up onto the edge of the, not the edge, but near the pond, the hockey pond. But that building, as small as it was, had been added onto twice. Once the front porch had been rebuilt as a part office, and the backside it was still visible. I could see the old line of demarcation. 10 years later, it was only 25-foot frontage or something like that. 10 years later, we wanted to expand, so we expanded onto the right side, added about 8 feet on that, 10 feet back, and then a couple of years later we had a little shanty on the back side of that, and we still were growing. This is, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but we still were growing, but we run out of land. We hadn't run out of building or desire. We ran out of land, and that's one reason why the journal was moved in about 1958, I think it was, to the present location, which was then a factory building, the most famous one in Lakeville. At that time, when we bought the journal, the front office, small as the building was, the front office was divided in half, with a real estate office on one side and a general office on the other side.
Was that Fish Real Estate?
No. It was a man from Salisbury whose home was up in the corner of the Lime Rock Road, a sharp corner. I don't remember his name.
Stone?
No. I can't tell. He had that. And we were crowded into about an 8 by 10 foot section. The entire editorial, advertising, bookkeeping, and every other thing except the actual press work and out and back and the composition in that little bitty space. It was very interesting. But we still rattled around because I was the sole advertising manager. I was a publisher. I was the editor. I was the editorial writer. And until I could get a bookkeeper, I kept books, and off and on for many years when I lost bookkeepers, I kept books. I sold advertising, as I said. I tried to get out and around to see people. I attended as many meetings as I could. And then I had to go out back to help put the paper together, because we had one other employee, except Mrs. Belcher. And that was Charles Barnum. Barney, we call him. He lived on Orchard Street. He had been there for a good many years. He had formerly been a carpenter. His father-in-law, Mr. Jones, had run the thing, and he became a printer. And he learned his trade right there. Mrs. Belcher learned her trade right there. And I think I learned most of my trade right there. And from then on, most everybody else that we hired learned that trade right there, because there were no skilled newspaper men around except Jack Bell, who had been a part-time reporter and a top-notch sports writer for local sports. At that time, Salisbury and Lakeville had baseball games, and it was bitter rivalry, and Jack wrote beautiful stories about this rivalry, among other things. Beautiful rivalry, of course, with Millerton and so forth. Hop Rudd has mentioned those things. But Jack sort of drifted away when I walked in. I think he had had hopes of running the paper, but something happened. Either he didn't get the backing of that he needed from his father, who was a lawyer in town, or he really didn't want to. I don't know. But I found I had to write most of the stories for the first year, because the income from the journal was practically zilch, as they say. I have a little book which was about 5 by 7 inches, about 40 pages thick, in which I kept track of all the income and all the outgo, everything, including a pencil purchased, item by item, and including newspapers sold one by one, and all the expenses. And it didn't fill up that book in 6 months. And the records beforehand bear me out. May still exist. Mr. Ben Jones' recordings of a daily take. It might have been $5.38. Mm-hmm. He sold other things on the side, but that was the daily income. And frankly, I wasn't too discouraged, because of the fact that the journal at that time was a small 4-page local paper struggling, meant that it was for sale for a very reasonable price, even for those times. For these times, and 50 years later, 40 years later.
Would you care to mention the price?
It was, I'll put it broadly, it was well under $10,000. That's incredible, isn't it?
Yes.
Now I won't mention the price that we finally wound up asking for, but that came after 40 years. So the bookkeeping was very minimal at that time, and I didn't feel I could afford a full-time bookkeeper. I knew I couldn't afford a full-time bookkeeper, because the journal itself cost 5 cents a copy. We had two full-time employees. We had taxes on the building, and we were paying rent at that time on the building until a year or two later we made a deal with Mrs. Jones to buy the building for also a minimal sum. And the expenses, the income was very small, but the expenses were very small, but the income was commensurate.
Even smaller.
Well, I won't go into details, but because it was a very interesting experience. This was just in 1940, spring of 1940, just when the world in Europe was going to pieces. There was war going on. Everybody was screaming about helping Britain, and there was a great fear and great argument about whether or not the United States should enter the war. And we started, a brand new business, without any backlog of cash, without knowing anybody in town, and just hoping. Well, it went like that. I think I did finally break down and hire someone to take telephone calls.
Was Anne working on the paper then?
And to jot down the nickels and dimes we collected, and the dollars and $10 we owed. I don't know whether I advertised, but the word got about, and a young woman walked into my shop early on from Sharon and said, I'd like a job as your bookkeeper. I said, do you know anything about books? She said, no, but I can learn. I said, I don't either, but I'm learning. She said, I hesitated because she wanted probably $10 or $12 a week, you see. She said, oh, don't worry about that. I can babysit for you on the side, separately, you see. Mm-hmm. So I can work part-time and do part-time babysitting. I think we hired her on that basis for a while, and then we finally she stayed for a year or so, and then from then on I had a procession of bookkeepers, which I won't go into now, at the 89th edition. Now, what do you want to know, Donald? The early term, you asked about Anne. The early year, the first year, Anne practically never entered the shop. She did write because she had written previously odds and ends. She liked to write. She's a very, you well know, Donald, a very good poetess in her own right, or poet, I would say. She had written, and she was very articulate and made friends very easily. So she started a little shopping column, which took hold very well, and it got our name around quite a bit. She went by car to Tarrington and to Canaan and places that had never heard of the Journal before. But she hadn't done any work in the office or the shop until 1941, when Pearl Harbor came along and the world exploded, and we were really utterly confused. Everybody was patriotic, of course, and even I, with my bad ears and theoretically an important job of disseminating news, and being a little bit on the upper edge of the age bracket for the draft, I was registered as 4F or something, and what I don't.
That was the term.
But I was had a little guilty conscience and behind it. But here I had a job and a paper to run and a family to support. So I compromised and I offered my services in war work down at Tarrington. I thought it would be a part-time basis. The upshot of it was that they said I was hired immediately. I was to go up to Canaan to help put the Canaan Magnesium plant together, which was started from scratch very shortly thereafter, which was producing magnesium, which was a new element for manufacturing lightweight plane wings and things like that. It had never been tried, and this method of getting magnesium from the ground and from ore was entirely brand new. They worked furiously. When I went up there, I'll tell you in a minute how they worked, but when I went up there, they said, you check in up there, you got a job. I said, okay, when do I start? They said, now, when I got up there. I picked up the phone in Canaan and phoned my wife and said, look, I'm stuck. I'm on a 70-hour-a-week schedule. Somebody's got to run the paper. You go down and sit down at the front desk, and I'll come at night and help you out what you can't figure out, you see. And the two people out back will do their part. We'll get the paper out. So that's the way that she got into the Lakeville Journal early, and she got so fascinated with it and got so good about it and her job that she became a full-time editor and then editor-in-chief, full-time boss of Stuart Hoskins, and ran the paper better than I ever could have done it. And I think we actually made a little profit that year, which I had not achieved the first year before. That is how my wife, Ann Hoskins, got famous in town as editor-in-chief, and why she became, if I may say so, quite beloved in the town, because she knew everybody, tried to help everybody, and knew what was going on, and was in on many, many things. She was one of the women who started the kindergarten idea. There was no kindergarten in town then. She and Bill Barnett's wife and Tom Wagner's wife and half a dozen others got together and decided to start their own kindergarten. So they did. Then they decided that they ought to get some help. So they talked to the town. The town said, okay, we'll put a little money into it. And they survived for a year or two, and then the town finally took it over. That's how you got a kindergarten in town.
Okay.
And things like that happen. Pardon me. The early days were really rugged because there were times when we were subsisted on nothing, and really nothing at all. And there were times when I was hard put to it to pay two and a half people in the shop, let alone my wife and myself were doing work. And the hours we put in, of course, were terrific. And we would just skip our pay for a week or so and eat bread and water almost and survive. But there were children around, and we, incidentally, during all this time, we had two young children, age 4 and 8, I think, something like that. And my wife kept house for them, saw them off to school, got them lunches and dinners, and went to work. And I don't know yet how she did it. And she did it for 30-odd years, till they grew up. But back to the journal. The first year was very interesting. I got to know people. I think Bill Rainsford was the first person in town who really deliberately walked in and said hello to me, welcome.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And what was his position in town at that time?
He practically ran the town outside of Abe Martin. Bill Rainsford was a justice of the peace who kept the peace in town, who knew every person who was good or bad, who beated out justice with the most even-handed way. If anybody I ever knew, if they had him as a Supreme Court justice, they wouldn't need anyone else. And he also was a carpenter, expert carpenter. He was also probably on dozens of committees and things like that. And he was a wonderful guy. Incidentally, one little twist of this is his wife was caught the eye of my wife before we bought the journal, because at that era, in the late 30s, sometime, I think it was during 4th of July or something, they used to have a parade between Lakeville and Salisbury. They'd go all the way from Lakeville to Salisbury. And there was quite elaborate with bands and everything. They didn't just go from Salisbury to the cemetery. They went all the way. Or it might have been Memorial Day. There was Mrs. Rainsford, which we found out later. Anyway, there was this beautiful white object on top of a white horse, dressed in white, walking sedately in his parade as the only person on horseback. And that always struck me. And said, look, there's an angel in Lakeville. We were driving through Lakeville. I don't know, she may have had angel wings on for some reason, maybe pre-Christmas. But remember that we found out later it was Mrs. Rainsford. Yeah. Bill Rainsford was the first one. I don't know who the others were. We finally got to know them very well. That took care of the first year. Then I got sidetracked for two years, I think, in War Work. And I would finish my stint of 70 hours helping in a very nominal way, but helping to put this Mag plant together, which was really critical to the war effort up in Canaan. It was wonderful the way they worked at it, because they were pouring concrete for footings that went into the big building, it's still there, and getting magnesium out from the finished product out of the other end of the building. They were working so fast. They didn't wait till the building was finished. Mm-hmm. But then, a year later, when that was finished, I went down to Tarrington and worked at the Tarrington Company for a year grinding bearings for airplanes and other things like that, which was interesting, but just laborious hand work. But it helped the war effort, but it didn't help my Lakeville Journal, they say. Finally, that petered out, and we were so still so broke, even with my added income, we were still so broke that when that petered out, I came back and spent 6 months or 8 months in a little local Lakeville Products, was it called then, in the present journal building, which was manufacturing skis, I think, for the army, and among other things. And then they got into the side manufacturing of tables. Mr. Howe of Hotchkiss created a table which we manufactured. And they were doing odds and ends of things with, and I was down to an 8-hour day there, and I was near at home, so I could pop in and out, see to the journal, but I still had to supplement my income to keep us out of the red or out of the deep red. Then that petered out, and I went back to the journal, and things settled down. The war came to an end finally, and from then on, I was just slugging, slowly, slowly growing. I did make some innovations fairly early, which I was quite proud of. The journal back shop was composed of one linotype of a composing tables on which the type was put together, and the linotype type, and the pages were put together and locked up in frames, taken downstairs, put onto the press to print. Upstairs there was a lot of hand type still in use from the past years when it had been very essential, but it was now slowly being discarded. But we used it for headlines. When I first took over, there was no such thing as a headline rated larger than 10 points, which is a little bit larger than the paragraph heading now. I took over and we started hand setting one and two column heads for news stories, which was incredible because nobody around here had seen a headline in a newspaper before. I also wanted to get rid of this so-called boilerplate, and over maybe a year or two, I was able to get rid of it eventually. But even before then, I was very proud of the fact that we had built up the newspaper from 4 pages, local news and advertising, to 10 pages of local news and advertising. It was either 3 months' time or a year in 3 months' time. I don't remember which, but I remember being so proud I wrote an editorial about it. 10 pages in 10 weeks or something like that. And I had a repercussion from Don Warner's father, who was also Donald Warner, who lived in town, a well-known lawyer here, who phoned me about it one time and said, "Look, I can't find anything in the newspaper anymore, it's too big. Where is the news about the strawberry festival or whatever you want, say the church, or where is the news about Salisbury?" I said, it's on page 2. He said, oh, I never read page 2. That page 2 and 3 and 7 and 8 were pre-printed outside news that nobody ever read.
Mm-hmm.
It looked very fulsome, but nobody ever read them, really. He was mad because I changed the sequence of the thing. And very shortly thereafter, as soon as we not only had Lakeville and Salisbury news, but as soon as we had the rash to expand to Sharon news, that was heretical, because Sharon was a foreign country, and we finally went to Canaan, of all places, in Falls Village. People in Lakeville and Salisbury were really mad at us. They wanted a local newspaper, but a local newspaper meant to survive you had to get local advertising. There were all of two stores in town, Bill Barnett's store and one meat.
The grocery store. The
grocery store and A&P at that time. And we couldn't survive on that, you see, so we had to expand. And we did expand slowly until we covered not only Canaan and Sharon, but also Falls Village, Limerick, of course, and Cornwall, and down to Kent, and then up to Norfolk, and partially up into Sheffield. A little bit from Millerton, but those were on the edges, because there was no real reason why anybody down in Kent should read a newspaper called the Lakeville News, you see, unless we were better than anyone else.
But this did coincide in a sense, didn't it, with the regional school district?
The reason why I decided to expand was in 1938, the regional school, number one, had opened up and really was just going, getting really settled down when we took over the Lakeville Journal. And they were having their problems of the fact that nobody, all the Canaan students didn't know anybody in Lakeville or Salisbury or Kent and so forth. It was like putting six foreign countries together and trying to run them. I thought that was a very good opportunity for the Lakeville Journal to coincide with the area covered by the high school. And it worked out beautifully that way, because slowly, with the news, the people, and with the mix-up of the students, the people got to know each other in each town, and they almost got to like each other. It took a long while. But there was an awful lot of rivalry at that time, and antagonism at that time, which I trust is now pretty well gone. They had held things together, and the churches got together, and even the baseball teams got together sometimes. That helped us. Frankly, I don't think we could have done it if the high school hadn't existed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little skeptical that the high school could have done as well as it had, as soon as they had, without the Lakeville Journal backing them.
Yes, I remember Dr. Stoddard pored over the Lakeville Journal every Thursday when the paper came.
He did what to
Dr. Stoddard, the principal of the high school, would just pore over the Lakeville Journal.
I know, but he would pore over the Lakeville Journal, but he also would blast the Lakeville Journal every once in a while. But we became very good friends. He was an interesting character who I got to admire very much. And he used to come in when he got into all sorts of trouble, which I won't go into, because of complications of people who didn't like him. He used to come in and talk to us, frankly, Ann and I, in the evening when we were trying to get some work done, he'd talk to us about his problems, and we'd commiserate and so on. And we'd learn an awful lot of behind-the-scenes things that never got into print, you see. But that's one of the pluses, actually, of being a publisher and an editor of a small-town paper. You get to know things that 50% of it may never be printed, but it's a background for what is printed, and you can do a better job of what you write about things. without playing favors, without prevaricating, without covering up anything. We would not cover up things that we thought were wrong. When we first started to write to include news of crime in the area, the Canaan Barracks, we had no local policeman, did we, except Bill Rainsford as justice, mm-hmm. but no local.
Not until later.
We got news from the barracks, which they were not used to giving out, and ran little, very short things about people who had been convicted or arrested or this or that. The response was almost negative at the first. People, very important people in town, phoned and said, look, you're giving us a bad image. This is a nice community, we love each other and so forth. I said, oh, very good. But if people don't know that their house might be robbed or something else might happen, how are they going to protect themselves, or how are they going to maneuver? And finally, they more or less came around to our point of view, but it was quite a push. Mm-hmm. They were not used to any kind of criticism in print of anything that happened in town. They would much prefer to cover it up, although all these fine, fine people were doing their best in their own way, by means of various wonderful local organizations, to keep the town on an even keel and to make it work. I give them full credit all down the line on that score. We tried to cooperate. Turn it off for a minute.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your experiences during the war years of the journal?
Well, the war years were very interesting because everything was rationed. People now say rationed, but I say rationed, including gas and food and things to buy. And it made it very difficult because people didn't want to advertise what you couldn't buy, so our income was curtailed a great deal. Aside from that, it made living a little bit difficult too, because my wife found that she, after a while, to buy a pound of sugar, she had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and stand in line, and there were 30 other people ahead of her to get a pound of sugar for the family, or things of that nature. And people like Martha Briscoe blasted the system because she didn't feel it was necessary at all. There was an adequate amount of food in the country, but it was funneled primarily, of course, to the army, but they had ignored the necessity to keep the public reasonably happy. But gasoline was another matter which they had to ration, and that was kept us from going to Tarnton to sell advertising and things of that sort. But this early rising really got the women of this town furious, because it did no one any good. They might as well have gotten there at 10 o'clock in the morning and lined up as well. Earlier and earlier, nobody got the benefit of it. I forget how they solved that problem, but it petered out after a while. But I was going to say something else about the war. The attitude in this town, Lakeville and Salisbury particularly, I presume Sharon too, was very interesting to me. I try to run an even-handed editorial comment in editorials. By the way, I had instituted editorials, which is purely personal comment, labeled as such. It has nothing to do with news, but it's an integral part of good newspapers, because it gives a a point of departure for discussion about big issues. And I had written editorials about the war and its impact on the war and local things. But Salisbury, of course, is named after a town in England, and Salisbury people were very pro-British. And well-known people like Bob Osborne and others, whom I can't recall at the moment, but very well-known people, were 90% pro-British, which was logical. But they wanted to enter the war before 1941, you see, before Pearl Harbor, to help the British. And they really were very active in pushing that. On the other hand, there was a group in the country popped up called